For being here, thank you for worshiping with us. We appreciate you. If you're visiting, we appreciate you especially this morning. The past few months, we've done some lessons talking about, is belief in God reasonable? And sometimes we hear this accusation that Christianity does not align with science, that science has disproven Christianity. And I have hoped through this series of lessons to demonstrate otherwise. Science is a desire for knowledge, and the beginnings of science are founded in the principle that God does exist and that we want to understand how God operates in this world in a natural sense, and that will help us to appreciate when he does act in a supernatural sense. When you look at the history of science, that's what you see. And so science is not mutually exclusive to God, nor is science contradictory with the Bible. And so hopefully we've done that. And this will actually be the last super technical lesson, more technical lesson that we will do in this series. The next lesson will be just a summation of things that we've gone over. And so it may be technical in a sense, but it's things that we've already gone over. And then the next lesson after that will follow the gospel meeting, and we'll talk about why people will still have some issues or some disagreements or some issues with pride or maybe some issues of deception that we're going to have to sift through even after we present this information. And so I know there will be much weeping, whether that be for the joy of these lessons being over or whether that be because you have felt so invigorated by these lessons that you will be so upset that we will close this lesson series. But we will, I think, from time to time return to things of this nature, so don't become too upset or don't become too excited, whichever line that you fall on. But how we view our origins is of extreme importance. How we view our origins makes a profound impact on our view of the world and on our values. It tells us what we would value and what we don't value. Either we come from a creator who loves us and values us and appreciates us and has a purpose and plan for us, or we are mere happenstance in a chaotic and pointless universe. Which viewpoint would you like to have? As we talked about last week, macroevolution teaches us basically that we are no better than a cockroach with makeup. And I do not want to subscribe to that viewpoint, and I do not think at all that the information available to us would lead us to that conclusion. The Bible tells us that we are the reflection of God's image, that we are incredibly valued, that we are loved, that our lives have meaning and purpose. The Bible also affirms that we have a grand designer that is responsible for the incredible diversity and complexity of life on this planet. The number one worldview in opposition to this, as we talked about last week, the number one worldview taught in schools around the world, on vacations, even to landmarks and national parks, in textbooks, and in everywhere else you can imagine, is macroevolution, which denies this identity and this meaning. It is dangerous. It tears people away from God every single day. And it is our responsibility to resist this onslaught of Satan by equipping ourselves by the power of God. And the better our defense, the more effective we become to that end. And so what we need is an informed, empowered, and passionate defense for reasonable faith. And that's what the Bible calls us to provide. And that's what the Bible tells us we can be affirmed by. In Isaiah chapter 41, for instance, in verses 10 through 13, God says, "Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Behold, all those who were incensed against you shall be ashamed and disgraced. They shall be as nothing. And those who strive with you shall perish. You shall seek them and not find them, those who contended with you. Those who war against you shall be as nothing, as a non-existent thing. For I, the Lord your God, will hold your right hand, saying, fear not. I will help you." And so we have an empowered defense provided for us. We're able to make reasonable dialogue, reasonable discourse to present the idea that God exists. Or as the New Testament says, and as I've covered with the girls on numerous occasions in our Wednesday night evidences class, But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. That's a challenge. That last part of that is definitely a challenge. I would also suggest to you that providing an informed, empowered, and passionate defense also requires a great deal of commitment. And that is what we are here to do. And so in our previous lesson, the lesson just before this, we talked about what the fossil record does not show. And that primarily focused on how macroevolution is not supported in what we see in the world. Rather, the Bible is supported. We're going to give more of a pro case for that for the Bible today. But we kind of focused on that idea in Romans chapter 3 and verse 4. Let God be found true and let everyone else be found to be a liar. And essentially this sermon focused on two points. I know it didn't seem like that. It was like 55 minutes, but it was only two points. That the fossil record in geology, they do not support the evolutionary timeline. They do not support the evolutionary expectation. And if you were not here for that lesson, then the notes are available at the back, and everything is available online as well. Second point we made in that previous lesson, that the fossil record geology do not show the validity of alleged transitional forms. And we talked about how, you know, Lucy and monkeys and apes did not transition into humans. We don't have any evidence of that. We do not have any evidence of reptiles turning into birds. We do not have any evidence of a horse coming from something that was not a horse. Those are some of the things that we focused on. And again, those notes are available to us. That's what we talked about in the previous lesson. The fossil record does not support this number one antagonistic worldview against Christianity. What we will talk about today is what the fossil record does show. And towards the end of our lesson, we will kind of transition from the fossil record into geology a little bit and thinking about Noah's flood as we do that. But we want to look at some other things first. And the first area that we want to look at, which is available to us to provide us an informed defense of the scriptures, are just a few basic facts in the fossil record. And when we want to turn to Genesis chapter 1, we're going to look at these verses, I think, a couple times in this lesson, because these verses do tell us about the nature of creation and how things are created. And that will help us as we look into the evidence available to us in the fossil record to measure that against the Bible and to see that the Bible is very much factual, it is very much evidence-based, and so is faith. Genesis chapter 1, starting in verses 11 and 12. This is right in the midst of this creation account. Then God said, let the earth sprout vegetation. Plants yielding seed and fruit trees on the earth, bearing fruit after their kind with seed in them. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. And God saw that it was good. Now God did this, and it says there was evening and there was morning, a third day. So this is about halfway through this creative process. And so what we see is that orange trees do not turn into gardenias. We see that mangroves do not turn into cactuses. Each plant produces each plant. There are variations, of course, in each species or in each kind, and we'll see different species within kinds, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But that's in regards to vegetation. That's the nature of the vegetation that God created. And when we look into the fossil record, that's what we see. In verse 21, skimming down to verse 21, God created the great sea monsters, or beasts, and every living creature that moves, with which the water swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind, and God saw that it was good. And God gives them the ability to procreate, the ability to sexually reproduce according to their kinds. And then in verses 24 through 25, that's after the fifth day, now we're pressing on. Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind. And it was so. God made the beasts of the earth after their kind and the cattle after their kind and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And God saw that it was good. Now, we've probably read through this 1,000 times, but have we thought about it from a biological perspective? Have we thought about it from a reproductive perspective? Probably not. That's kind of what we're going to be doing today as we think about the fossil record. So a couple of key details that we want to think about. And we're going to use some technical terms, but I'll define them for us. What we see is a top-to-bottom order. What macroevolution would expect is a bottom-to-top order. That's just a fancy way of saying that evolution expects a bacteria to produce all manner of different things, mammals and birds and reptiles and every other form that you can think of. Whereas what we see in the fossil record is very much in line with this, is that we see a variety of different things, mammals and reptiles and birds, all from the beginning, and then we see them diversify. So what macroevolution believes is we start out with this tiny point and we go outwards, big old V, and that's what you'll see in Darwinian textbooks and in biology textbooks in high school and things. But what we see in creation is that we don't go to an apex, one point. We have this broad diversity from the beginning that gets even more diverse in the fossil record. Another way of describing this would be that disparity precedes diversity. Disparity means things are totally different. Diversity means that there are minor differences in those. So size would be a minor difference. That would be diversity. Whereas disparity would be birds are birds and mammals are mammals. So we have disparity from the beginning, which precedes diversity. And when the Bible again describes creation, namely the creation of animals and plants, it specifies that God created things according to kinds. And a little bit of Hebrew for you, the word that's used consistently in Genesis chapter 1 as well as Genesis 6 and 7 is the Hebrew word mean. Mean. It's pronounced M-E-A-N. Mean. And that word specifies in the Bible that they would reproduce according to these kinds. So, giving us a little bit of a definition, the outline of biblical usage defines this Hebrew term for us. It tells us that groups of living organisms belong in the same created kind if they have descended from the same ancestral gene pool. So, in the beginning we have a horse form, a horse kind, that produces different sorts of horses. Clydesdales and miniature horses, and Appaloosas and every other imaginable form that you can see. This does not preclude new species because this represents a partitioning of the original gene pool. So again, we start with a horse form and it can grow and change in size and things, but it doesn't change from being a horse. It's a partitioning of the original gene pool. Information is lost or conserved. It's not gained. Not in a major way, at least. A new species could arise when a population is isolated and breeding occurs. By this definition, a new species is not a new kind, but a further partitioning of an existing kind. So that's just a fancy way of saying we start with a horse, and then we get different horses along the way. We don't start with a bacteria and gradually, eventually, get to a horse. Does that make sense? So God created according to kinds. Just to give us some examples of this, there are the bear kind. And then the Linnaean system, which is pretty commonly used in science today. These are known as families. We have the Ursids, the bear family. That would include things like polar bears and grizzly bears. As different as they are, they're still bears. Canids, dogs. So a Chihuahua and a Great Dane, they're still both dogs. Felids, cats. So you've got a house cat. We've got about a 15-pound black and white cat, tuxedo cat, I think she is. And she is frustrating, but she is nowhere near a lion, but they're both cats. And then we also have equids. Equids, where we get our word equestrian from, we get horses, different sorts of horses, but still horses. So those are some different examples, and we got variation among these original kinds illustrated in different species and display different characteristics that allow them to be differentiated based upon species. Again, a miniature horse, an Appaloosa, a Clydesdale, a Chihuahua versus a Great Dane versus a Greyhound, and you see that. You see variation. So the Bible tells us that we start with several basic and very different forms. Very different. And they diversify through species and different sorts of those forms. Now, evolution, again, expects the opposite. It would expect what we call a bottom-to-top ordering of things. In Isaiah chapter 45, we're going to read a lot from Isaiah, I think, in this lesson. Isaiah talks about turning to those created things and worshiping those and putting too much stock in those as opposed to God. So, very appropriate that we would use verses from Isaiah. Isaiah 45 and verse 9. Woe to the one who quarrels with his maker, an earthenware vessel among the vessels of earth, will the clay say to the potter, what are you doing? Or the thing that you are making say he has no hands? And so this is really a challenge that's given. Verse 10, woe to him who says to a father, what are you begetting? Or to a woman, to what are you giving birth? What we see in Genesis chapter 1 is unequivocally true, and the fossil record demonstrates that, as do other areas that we're not dealing so much heavily with, genetics and biochemistry and things of that nature. But this is not a collegiate course. So let's give you another example. Just a little illustration. You probably can't read all these, but you've got differences. You've got things like panthers and lynxes and bobcats, and you've got leopards and cheetahs. And then you've got all the way up to a tiger. The tiger is the biggest of the cat family that's still in existence today. It doesn't mean that there weren't bigger ones in the past. It just means that's the biggest one today. And so you see variation, but what you see in all of that is what? Cats. Every one of those is a cat. That's what you see in the fossil record. That's what you see from the beginning. A little quotation for you. This is from a book called Divine Action and Natural Selection, Science, Faith, and Evolution by a couple guys, Joseph Seckbach and Richard Gordon. And they said, the course of appearance and taxa, that would be different types of animals, and the fossil record is top down. What the Bible demonstrates, what macroevolution would be contradictory to. What is more dramatic is that the number of phyla different forms, which should increase by stages over long periods of time, actually decreases. So we have kinds that go extinct over the course of the 6,000-year history of the Earth. Darwin's assumptions have been literally overturned, because remember, they expect a bottom to top. Now what we see is a top to bottom. They have been overturned, and the fact of the fossil record, the paleontology, has definitely and clearly invalidated his theory. What we also see, in addition to this pattern, which would support the biblical framing of things as opposed to macroevolution, is we see explosive origins, that things poof into existence, and that's exactly what we see in the fossil record. We see complexity from the beginning, incredible complexity, intricate body plans, genetic material that is fascinatingly detailed. It's unparalleled in complexity. Again, another passage from Isaiah 40 and verse 26. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars, the one who leads forth their host by number. He calls them all by name because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one of them is missing. That's God. That's created. Creative power that God has created. Incredible complexity and diversity from the beginning. A few quotes in regards to this, and the first one is from Eugene Koonin. He said, the principal types seem to appear rapidly and fully equipped with the signature features of the respective new level of biological organization. No intermediate grades or intermediate forms between different types are detectable. That's in relation to what we talked about last week. We don't see transitional forms in the fossil record. We see things that are alleged to be transitional forms, but upon further inspection are not. And we also see, again, highly equipped, fully equipped, significant detail from the beginning. Stephen Meyer, this is from that book that Tom was so nice to give me on my birthday. 600 pages. Thank you very much, Tom. The animal forms that arose in the Cambrian, remember that's our first layer in the fossil record, not only did so without any clear material antecedent, they came on the scene complete with digital code. Dynamically expressed integrated circuitry and multi-layered hierarchically organized information storage and processing systems. And yes, it is as detailed as that sounds. Explosive origins from the beginning. I want to show you two illustrations of this. Fossils are fascinating. There's a lot to it, but they are fascinating. I'll show you two examples. This is from the Burgess Shale, and that's just a big old fossil bed up in British Columbia, Canada. These are different fossils that were found in the Burgess Shale. Remember, the first layer in the fossil record. Look pretty organized, don't they? Multiple legs, ribs, antennae. Incredibly diverse. What you also notice about these animals is that they are all sea-dwelling creatures.
something interesting about the Burgess Shale. It's up in the mountains. How'd they get there? We'll talk about that a little bit later on.
Another example, I'm going to butcher this one. The Maoshanshan Shale in China. In Changsheng, China. Look at these creatures that we find. Trilobites and different worms and things, proboscises. And
incredibly diverse, incredibly designed in the first layer that we have. So how did they get from a bacteria to that without any transition?
Strong evidence for the Bible. A third point that we want to talk about. Animals exist with a form. Then they go extinct, or they're extinct. That means they're still in existence with the same form. It's no transitions. So what we see is when we compare animals, what Darwin would do in his models is he would start here, and he would branch out this way, and he branch out this way, and branch out that 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 way. But what do we see in the fossil record? Something exists in this form, it continues. Something exists in this form, and it continues. There's no change. Morphology just would mean significant change. We don't see that in the fossil record. Again, the Bible very much meets that expectation, very much affirms exactly what we see. Richard Dawkins, you may have heard of him, he wrote something called The Blind Watchmaker. One of the classic arguments for the creation of the universe was made by William Paley several hundred years ago. He said it was a watchmaker analogy. And we talked a little bit about that. When you come across a watch in nature, you know that it's been designed because it has a signature of design. He ridiculed that idea in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, but he also said this, which I find to be very interesting. And I will say that I do get excited about this one. He said, it is as though the fossils were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. You betcha! Both schools of thought, punctuationists and gradualists. Gradualists would be people that believe in Darwinian evolution. Punctuationists would be people that believe in explosive periods of growth. Because Darwin's been proven wrong, they're trying to backpedal into something else. They despise so-called scientific creationists equally, and both agree that the major gaps are real, that they are true imperfections in the fossil record. The only alternative explanation of the sudden appearance of so many complex animal types in the Cambrian era is divine recreation, and guess what? Both of us reject that alternative, and so we have to make things up. Darwin's been proven wrong. What are we going to do now? Well, you get all sorts of different things. You get punctuated equilibrium. You get evolutionary developmental biology. You get all sorts of different fields trying to backpedal and trying to figure things out. But they run into the same problems. It's not there. What the Bible tells us is true. Of course, he would be an atheist. We have somebody who's a creationist, Stephen C. Meyer. We have some difference of viewpoints with him. But, again, he says, intelligent design, that God created the universe, also explains the observed stasis. Stasis just means there's no significant change. The observed stasis in the fossil record. Cambrian species at the bottom tend to persist unchanged in their basic forms over time. Animal body plans that define the higher taxa, including classes and phyla, that would be disparity as opposed to diversity, also remain especially stable in their basic architectural design, showing no directional change over geological history after the first appearance of Cambrian. As a result, the morphological disparity between distinct animal body plans remains unbridged. We don't have transitional forms. It's a fancy way of saying that. We don't have them. What we do have is things created from the beginning, according to kinds, just as the Bible says. Our next area of study here, and we'll go through this a little bit quicker, soft tissue preservation. When you look at the fossil record and you find all sorts of fossils, and really millions of fossils have been found, different pieces of bones and different other things, what you see is soft tissue preservation. What we mean by that, things like blood cells, proteins, things that have no reasonable explanation for surviving for 150 million years, a billion years, things that could survive a couple thousand years. Soft tissue preservation. That really is completely unfeasible for macroevolution. Let's look at a few examples of this. You can look these up if you want. Again, they're in the notes. They'll be on the slideshow online as well. We have something found in the Dakotas, and they named it Dakota in 1999. It was a mummified, nearly intact hadrosaur. That's scales. Scales. And they're supposedly hundreds of millions of years old. How does a scale survive that long? It'd be like finding your skin in your coffin in a million years. Sorry to say that doesn't happen. The Bible tells us that things break down in death. You remember what was said about Lazarus? He was in the tomb for 4 days. Don't break the seal because he's breaking down. That's Dakota. We've got Leonardo, who's also gross, but tells us that we have soft tissue preservation. A lot of skin on him. Still, skin and muscle structures. 90% of his skeleton was covered in soft tissue. How do you explain that? Unless from a biblical perspective. One that was so elegantly preserved looks like a statue. That's not dressed up. That's how it was found. It's called a four-legged tank. It was found in Canada. It's a nodosaur. It's the best preserved fossil of its kind. How? How is that preserved? And then they recently found a woolly mammoth with hair, skin, and blood preserved. And they named it Yucca, and I would agree, it is Yucca. And this is one of many examples of woolly mammoths that have been found preserved that could not possibly be explained from a macroevolutionary standpoint. Things aren't preserved that long in macroevolution. In the real world, things are not preserved that much. In the biblical perspective, yeah, you could see that happening. And you do see it happening. Other examples, and we'll go again quickly through these. You can look them up if you desire. One called B-Rex. There was, in the year 2000, there was a skeleton out of an adolescent T-Rex found by Bob Harmon. So they named it B-Rex after Bob. The skeleton had to be transported. It's huge. So it has to be transported. So they broke it up to be transported, and then they would reassemble it when they came back. And one of the teams was led by a lady named Mary Higby Schweitzer. She took the thigh bone. She broke the thigh bone. You can see the fractures in the thigh bone. And they opened it up. Guess what they found in there? They found blood cells. They found proteins. It's hard enough to explain that surviving 1,000 years, let alone 65 plus million years that is required for macroevolution. In addition to that, another dinosaur bone was found. This one from a Triceratops. This is a Triceratops horn that was found, pretty massive. And that was found, and they broke it open, and guess what they found again? Soft tissue, intact, detailed cells that are on record that have been published in the scientific literature that have not been explained other than from a biblical creation, young earth perspective. Scientists have shown over and over again that fossilization can be mimicked. In fact, in one fossil area, they found this hammer. And this fossil bed was dated to be 110 million years old. Look at that hammer. It looks like a hammer I have in my garage. Not 110 million years old, I'm sorry. In fact, humans, according to macroevolution, have only been around for 1 million years. Who was using that hammer 99 plus million years before humans came into the scene? You can fossilize something with the right amount of heat and pressure in 24 hours. 24 hours. Not just upon visual inspection will it look like an actual fossil, but you can take an electron microscope and look at it, and it still looks just like a fossil. In 24 hours, you can fossilize something. Second and last point, we do see variation within kinds. That's not the problem. The Bible teaches variation with kinds. We've seen that in Genesis 1 with regards to vegetation, verses 11 and 12, with regards to beasts, with regards to animals and sea beasts in verse 21 of Genesis 1, and verses 24 through 25. We see with land animals. We see variation. In fact, turn with me to Acts 17 because I want to show you something that the Bible does teach. And I've referenced it already. Acts chapter 17, Paul is preaching to a bunch of smart philosophers. And guess what he says in Acts 17, verse 24? The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things, and he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him. So he's not far from each one of us. For in him we live and we move and we exist, as even some of our own poets have said, for we also are his children, being then the children of God. We ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to all men everywhere that they should repent, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. All created from one man, and that one man, everybody, was named Adam. Genesis chapter 1. Even Eve, created from the rib of Adam. Let's think about some different examples of variation. And remembering, of course, that variation is not denied in the Scripture. It's actually affirmed. So microevolution, adaptation, is not the problem. Macroevolution is what we do not see. And it is a worldview hostile towards Christianity. You may have seen this before. You see it in biology textbooks. I remember seeing this in my biology class when I was a sophomore in high school. These are Darwin's finches, they're commonly referred to. This is from his journal. One of the pictures from his journal. He studied the finches in the Galapagos Islands. And that's part of that growth of on the origin of man, on the origin of species, rather, that he wrote. And he points out that you see variation with these finches. He looks at four different species, says they look different, don't they? Yes, they do. Some of them have bigger beaks, some of them don't. There's no denying that they are different. Yet, what's interesting about all of this is that Darwin did not once speak of the finches on the origin of species. That's not what we're taught. He didn't once speak of them there. It was not until later on that these became icons of evolution. There's no doubt that variation is present in the finch kind, but those are still finches. Another one that's commonly used, moth. Peppered moth. You can hardly even see this one, and that's the point. It's dark, and then you get a peppered one. These are found in England. These are English ones in Birmingham, England. And Bernard Kettlewell was the first one to study these fascinating creatures on record. He noticed two main variations of color within the species. One was very light, the one on the right, and one was very dark, the one on the left. Evolutionists often cite these moths as being examples of macroevolution. They claim the darker version was able to thrive more because they could blend into the darker birch trees that are found in England, thus hiding from predatory birds. But something that is not said is that these moths don't actually rest on the bark of trees. They rest under the leaves of birch trees. And so you get them staged in a place that they would really never be found. So why would they develop this adaptation to blend into the bark on trees when they never spend any time on the bark of the trees? Speculations run wild.
And even if this is really why the darker moths became more prevalent, which is itself suspect, this shows, again, adaptation. Not macroevolution. Those are still moths. Show you a more humorous one. This is Bertina Smelser. They live in Pennsylvania. This is a great family of Christians. And this is her son, Zachary. Now, Bertina's kind of small. I mean, she's pretty petite. But Zachary is huge. This is a one generation difference. Now you get to know Scott. Scott's pretty big too, but I think Zach's even taller than Scott is. There's no doubt that there is variation in humans, but they're still humans, at least as far as I know. And you can see this out other places. You can see Aboriginal tribesmen, for instance. You can look at their bone structures. It's different than an Eskimo, than an Inuit, than a Maasai warrior in Africa. They're different, but they're still humans. As incredible as these variations can be, they are limited. They are constrained. Developmental mechanisms, and again, we're not getting into genetics. We could, but we're not going to. Restrict the degree to which organisms can change without deleterious consequences, without dying. And that has been proven over and over and over again in the laboratory. Our last point is going to be, I guess, a more biblically focused discussion. But it's in regards to evidence for Noah's flood. And we'll talk a little bit about the fossil record, but a lot of this is going to be geology. So just a few minutes here to think about this. It's, of course, described for us in Genesis 6, 7, and 8. We're not going to read all three of those chapters. We are familiar with this. We've learned this even when we were kids. Even in secular settings, they reference this. So we know what's happening here. The world has become so corrupt because of sin that God plans on destroying it with a global flood. And he chooses Noah because he is more righteous than anyone else. Still beset by sin, but more righteous than anyone else. He saves Noah and his family by placing them on an ark. Now, if we could demonstrate that there was indeed a global flood, that would go a long way, wouldn't it? To an informed defense of the scriptures. In fact, I would suggest to you that this is perhaps the greatest tool available to us in the fossil record, because what we would have is widespread evidence, not just located in the Maotian Shan Shale in China, or not just located in the Burgess Shale in British Columbia. We would have something that would be global, that anywhere you went, you would see demonstration of this. Guess what? We have evidence. We have evidence of rapid deposition. We're going to basically focus on two points that are evidences for the flood. We have rapid deposition, so things are laid down very quickly. And that's what we would expect from a flood of a global scale. I mean, we're talking about one of the biggest catastrophe in all of the history of the world. Dr. Bo Kirkwood, in a book entitled Creation versus Evolution, he said the flood was an event of supreme uniqueness, and nothing like it has ever been witnessed since. The worldwide flood of Noah's day would have significantly changed the topography and geology of the world as it was known then, and may be responsible for many of the formations we see today. So what we see is, first of all, a rapid deposition of plants and animals. So look at the fossil record, you get a huge amount of animals that are just laid down quickly, and then laid down quickly, and then laid down quickly. A massive graveyard. And in that, we find something called polystrate fossils. And polystrate fossils, they're a very fancy way of saying things that are across many layers. Things across many layers. So when you look at geology, or when geologists look at these rock layers, they say, okay, here's a million years, here's a million years, here's a million years, here's a million years. And then we get a big old tree
shooting through those millions of years. Or a whale that has been fossilized that crosses millions of years. That's pretty strong evidence, isn't it? Of rapid deposition. Something that would be expected from a flood. In addition to that, just the fact that we even have fossils. Because fossils are incredibly difficult to make. Because things get destroyed. Weather, animals, erosion, all destroy these things. And so it would require a rapid burial to explain the vast fossil beds that we even have. Especially that are preserved to the degree in which they are preserved. And we have grated bones. Grated bones require mass destruction, mass devastation. We have a rapid establishment of sediment layers across the continents. If you've ever watched Is Genesis History, talks about that. The Coconino Sandstone and the Schneebly Formation and all those different fancy terms that geologists use. Rapid laid down. Red sandstone, chalk beds, coal beds, all rapidly laid down. We also have rapid erosional boundaries between those layers. The most significant one would be the Great Unconformity that you can witness, particularly at the Grand Canyon. A knife edge, granite, no fossils found in the granite, layers on top of that. We see bent and folded layers of rock, which would require mass devastation, namely a flood. And the reason we know that it is from a flood is because of the waving patterns that we see on these layers. Waving patterns that are attributed to massive underwater erosion. The type of water that would cover mountains. The type of water that would move mountains. You can see all of this at the Grand Canyon. As a teenager, I had the privilege of going to the Grand Canyon. Extraordinary experience. If you ever have the opportunity to go to the Grand Canyon, go there. It is one of the greatest illustrations of the historicity, the validity of Noah's flood. Knife edge layers. The great unconformity at the base. The waving patterns is all there. It's like God saying, here's the flood in Arizona, go see it. Second major area, nature of the fossils that we find in the fossil record. What we see is in the layering. Again, from the bottom we have these shallow water invertebrates. Then we get amphibians and reptiles and mammals and birds. And that's why macroevolution believes that that was the growth of things. That was the stages of development of these things. But in actuality, what we see in conjunction with this geology and all these different things would suggest that we have this explosive force in the ocean. Genesis chapter 7 and verse 11. All the fountains of the great deep burst forth, burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were open. What happens when you have a massive surge of water come out of the ocean? You have waves. And those waves pull all the animals from the source of that, or sources, onto the continents. That's why we have these marine fossils in the Burgess Shale 7,000 feet above sea level. That's why on Mount Everest you can find sea creatures. That's why you find mosasaurs on every major continent. That order that we find aligns with what would be expected based on the description found in Genesis chapter 6, 7, and 8. The ocean floor would break open, creating tsunamis, which would dump shallow water invertebrates onto the continents first. And then you would have fish being suffocated over that. And then you would have amphibians and reptiles and mammals and birds and everything else. And that's not just true of animals, that's also true of the habitats in which those animals exist. In addition to that, we have footprints in the record. Footprints that were created from animals that are supposedly separated by millions of years in the fossil record. How do you explain that? Mass devastation. That's how you explain it. Because what happens when there's a flood? What do animals do? They go to higher ground. They go higher and higher. And of course, we find birds last because they fly. How would that happen? In addition to that, and this is just kind of tying these two points together, we see long transport of animals and sediments. We see animals of one type, say a trilobite or something that's ancient, from localized from a region in Africa or something on a mountain in the Rockies. How did that happen? We see dirt and we see rocks from China and the United States. How did that happen? Well, I can tell you. The flood. That's how it happened. When you ask the right questions, you get the right answers. In this series of lessons, we have been asking the right, challenging questions. And what is the reasonable conclusion? That the Bible is reliable, that God does exist, and the history of our world shows an origin that confers importance and value on us. Will we learn from those before us? I'll show you two last passages. Jeremiah 2:26-28. As the thief is ashamed when he is discovered, so the house of Israel is shamed. They, their kings, their princes, and their priests, and their prophets, who say to a tree, "You are my father," and to a stone, "You gave me birth." They have turned their back to me and not their face. But in the time of their trouble, they will say, "Arise and save us." But where are your gods, which you have made for yourself? Let them arise, if they can save you in the time of your trouble, for according to the number of your cities are your gods, O Judah. This is written 600 years before Jesus. We're here 2,000 years later, and people are still calling trees and rocks their father. And then 2 Peter, New Testament passage, this is about 30 years after Jesus, 30, 35 years after Jesus. Know this, first of all, that in the last days, mockers will come with their mocking, following after their own lusts and saying, "Where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation." For when they maintain this, it escapes their notice that by the word of God, the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water and by water, through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. But by his word, the present heavens and earth are being reserved for fire, kept for the day of judgment and destruction of godly men. The fossil record is a tool available to us to provide evidence for belief in God and to convince people that there's a judgment coming, that hell is real, that torment awaits those who have not acknowledged God as their Savior. In no way does the fossil record demonstrate the validity of macroevolution. Rather, it unequivocally agrees with the Bible. And so we sincerely hope that if you have struggled with the seeming irreconcilability of science and God, that these lessons have clarified matters for you. You are created in the image of God, but you have tarnished that image because of your sins. Let the one who created you recreate you in his beautiful and in his perfect image. If you have a need, please come forward as together we stand and sing.